Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent for Media General newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN, or listening to us on National Public Radio, or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind you of some of our upcoming events. On Tuesday, June 14th, we have Bianca Jagger, a longtime human rights activist, who will talk about the global refugee crisis. And on Wednesday, June 15th, Mstislav Rostropovich, the music director of the National Symphony Orchestra, will talk about the current conditions in Russia. And on Monday, May 20th, Dan Golden, NASA administrator, will present a speech entitled Space Exploration and America's Technological Future. Audio and videotapes, as well as transcripts, are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards available for you at the table. And you can't write those questions. And pass them forward, and I will ask as many as time allows. I'd like now to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly as I read their names. And please withhold any applause until all the names are read. Starting on your right is Rick Weintraub of the Washington Post. Lisa Burgess of the Journal of Commerce. Robert Dodge of the Dallas Morning News. John Fogarty, editor of Kiplinger California Letter and a past president of the National Press Club. Christina DeValle of Business Week. Ed Pinto, publisher of Aviation Daily. Ron Ricks, vice president for government affairs of Southwest Airlines. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, we have Christy Wise, a freelance journalist and chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Ginger Hartage, director of public relations for Southwest Airlines. Don Carney of the Houston Post and the member of the Press Club Speakers Committee who organized today's luncheon. Ronald Leiser, Washington bureau chief of Travel Agent Magazine. Maria Recio of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Martin Vanderwerf of the Arizona Republic. And finally, Dell Jones of USA Today. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdow-Dermont, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, today we are pleased to have with us Herbert Kelleher, Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer of Southwest Airlines. He has been described as a man who runs his company like a carnival sideshow, yet he has flat out beaten the pants off of just about every established airline in the country. Mr. Kelleher launched Southwest Airlines in 1971 with three airplanes and a crew of flight attendants sporting orange hot pants, white vinyl lace-up boots, and big hair. Playing on the name of Dallas's Love Field Airport, the company chose the letters LUV for its stock ticker symbol and announced no less a mission than spreading love all over Texas. It wasn't long before the company was making serious money and sharing its good feelings in other regions of the country. Much to the chagrin of the more established airlines, Southwest has grown from a blip on the radar screen to the nation's seventh largest carrier and the only one making any money. Its stock has appreciated a modest 150-fold since its initial public offering 23 years ago. Not bad. Mr. Kelleher's philosophy has been simple. Watch what the competitors are doing, watch them very closely, then do the exact opposite. The airline has not adopted the hub and spoke system. It is not part of any computerized multi-airline reservation system. It has made a religion out of slashing costs and a virtue out of being different. Imagine, if you will, that you are a passenger on a flight and you hear this announcement, which has been made on Southwest flights. Those of you who wish to smoke will please file out to our lounge on the wing, where you can enjoy our feature film, Gone with the Wind. Kelleher, to say the least, is not a conventional CEO. Few of his peers have ever dressed like Elvis, or Ethel Merman, or the Easter Bunny, or ordered their planes painted to look like whales. He schmoozes with his employees, who call him Uncle Herb. He stages weekly parties at the corporate headquarters, delivers instructions to his staff in rap, and has awarded prizes to passengers with the largest holes in their socks. Yet few others have engendered the loyalty from his employees that Mr. Kelleher has. A long list of organizations have named him Manager of the Year, and the once scornful competition is now falling all over each other trying to create their own low-cost startup airlines. President Clinton tapped him to be the only major airline executive to serve on a commission to study the plight of the industry. And that brings us to today's topic. The National Commission to Ensure a Strong, Competitive Airline Industry issued its final report late last year, offering ways to stop the hemorrhaging of money from the major carriers. Here to address us on his life as a commissioner is one of the country's most entertaining capitalists, Mr. Herbert Kelleher.
Thank you, Gil.
With respect to any honors that I have received, I told the Texas Breakfast Club this morning that there are four prerequisites to achieving those. First of all, you have to live to be 60. Secondly, you have to be in the same business for 20 years or more. Thirdly, you have to avoid indictment. And fourthly, you have to be continent. And if all those things coincide, then they start giving you honors. That was a very charming, delightful, and heartwarming introduction. But it reminds me of what Dr. Umberto Nordio said at an Air Transport World Luncheon many years ago in New York when he was selected as the airline CEO of the year. Now, you realize, and Jane Hickey knows me too well to let me get away with this, that I've just told you that I was at that award luncheon. That was designed to produce in your minds the idea that I might have received an award. That was not true. I was just helping the older guys to get to the potty and get their drinks. I have to confess, Jane, because you tell everybody anyhow. But Dr. Nordio got a wonderful introduction like that, and he said something that I've always remembered. And he said, you know, to the audience, he said, you know, such introductions are like perfume. They are to be sniffed, but please don't swallow it. But thank you very much. And after hearing about the most distinguished roster of speakers that you've had here recently, and those who will succeed me in the weeks to come, I must say that I'm very profoundly and very personally and very emotionally grateful that the National Press Club has seen fit to lower its standards sufficiently so that I could become one of its luncheon speakers. And when I say that, you must understand that it's said in the context of being 100% Irish. And you know the story about the Irish. The reason that the potato is the staple of the Irish economy, while oil is the staple of the Arab economy, is that the Irish got first choice. And I think that you're having me here is a great thing for America in a way, because it comports with the Jacksonian tradition of egalitarianism. And I think perhaps it's the same strain of egalitarian thought which led President Clinton to appoint me to the National Airline Commission. Put simply and succinctly, I think he was probably looking for the lowest common denominator of the airline industry, someone who bore the same relationship to airlines as plankton does to giant sea creatures. In fact, upon official presentation of the Commission's report to the President, to the Vice President, to the Secretary of Transportation, to the Chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, and to the Administrator of the FAA, I informed all auditors that the other members of the Commission had concluded that my appointment reduced the average IQ of the entity by approximately 10 points. And I think that's quite a feat since there were 15 people on it. But it was, as you'll remember, the National Commission to Ensure a Strong and Competitive Airline Industry. It was given 90 days to produce its report. It reminds one of the 90-day wonder second lieutenants of World War II. For instance, my older brother wound up on a destroyer, and his executive officer, 90 days before, had been a shoe salesman in Philadelphia. They were ordered to conduct convoys to Murmansk and wound up in the Caribbean instead, thanks to that. But it turned out we weren't 90-day wonders because the government printing office required 21 days to print the report. So we became 69-day wonders instead. Now, I want to tell you what I did, and this was purely out of the goodness and the charitable qualities of my heart and in the interest of good citizenship. I offered to print the commission's report overnight at Southwest Airlines. And I was really taken aback and somewhat disturbed when the chairman and some of the other members seemed to have the collected, albeit entirely unfounded, apprehension that this might cause the final text to reflect more favorably on Southwest Airlines than might otherwise have been the case. But the commission did produce a report after receiving copious amounts of oral and written testimony within that short period of time. And that really is a tribute, I think, to the excellence of its presiding officer, former Governor Gerald Biles, and to the dedicated and substantive and cooperative nature and focus of the other 14 members of the commission and the members of the commission staff, who really were dominated by goodwill, animated by sincerity, had a tremendous amount of energy, and responded with substantive alacrity to the magnificent leadership of Governor Biles. The test was severe. It was very draining. I pronounced it as the only job I'd ever had where you could simultaneously drink all night and still lose weight. And that will give you some idea of the test that it was. I was criticized for smoking in the Commerce Department auditorium. And that apparently is in violation of government rules. And my response was, well, I'll start smoking in the ladies' room. And if I'm apprehended, the smoking will be a secondary issue. I was put to the test when Randy Babbitt, the president of ALPA, got up and made a motion and looked down at me and said, and any commissioner that opposes this motion identifies himself ipso facto as a predatory pricer. I had a real tough time, and I did vote for it because I knew it wouldn't carry. And Governor Biles, every morning when I came in, would slip up to me and hand me a little vial of Visine and say, I think you ought to use this since you're going to be on CNN for the rest of the day. The adoption of the commission's report was, in effect, at least, unanimous. Now, John Peter Paul from the IAM, and incidentally, I told John early in the proceedings, John, you can have your way with me. I never cross a guy that's named after three saints. I'll take on one saint. I'll take on two saints, but not three saints. He filed what was labeled a dissent, but it was really a concurrence in Supreme Court terms, because John basically agreed with the recommendations that were made. He thought additional ones should have been made, and he emphasized some textual points that he thought should have been changed. Turning to the content, remember it was a 90-day commission to ensure a strong, competitive airline industry. And as I said early in the proceedings, it should have been a 45-day commission to ensure a strong airline industry because the competitive part of it had already been accomplished. The competition is there. As Randy Bennett, an economic genius at the Department of Transportation, disclosed to the commission, there's far more competition in the airline industry today than when it was regulated. And if you think about that a second, in Washington, you tend to focus on the number of airlines and to equate that with competition. Well, under the old regulated regime, you had Western, and guess what? It flew in the western part of the United States. I figured that all by myself. It took me a year. You had Eastern. It flew in the eastern part of the United States, and they didn't compete with one another. So the fact you had more carriers was meaningless. Today, there are 4,000 more competitive routes with two or more carriers flying them than there were under the old regime. And of course, when you're the consumer and you're going out to buy a ticket, the only thing of interest to you is how many carriers are flying the routes on which you want to fly, not theoretically and academically how many carriers are there in America. So the competitive part of it was soon dispensed with. But then you get to the strength part of it. And the commission basically said, what are the impediments to the airline industry regaining its strength. And one of them is that historically we have led the world in the efficiency and the technological superiority of our air traffic control system. The Commission noted that there has never been a major commercial industry in the United States whose minute-by-minute operating efficiency is capped by the daily operating efficiency of the federal government. And I'm referring to the air traffic control system because it tells you when you can push your plane back, when you can taxi it out, when you can take it off, where you can land it, when you can land it, when you can taxi it in, and when you can bring it to the jetway. The Commission also noted that there seems to be a fundamental inconsistency between the traditional and, I might say, stereotypical processes of government and the operation of a 24-hour-a-day, high-technology, capital-intensive air traffic control system. As an example, and this is not a criticism of the people of the FAA, by the way, who do a fabulous job under very difficult and constraining circumstances, namely government regulations that don't apply to an operating agency as opposed to a planning and studying agency. But as an example, the FAA cannot function well in a standard government environment where the procurement process is so laborious that it ordains that computers that the FAA orders are obsolete before they can be delivered. And that's absolutely the truth. At Southwest Airlines, we write off a new computer within 5 years, figuring it's economically obsolescent. It takes the FAA longer than 5 years to get a new computer. And that's not a good thing for aviation. The global positioning system, that's a satellite-based navigation air traffic control system. The Commission noted that trucks use this to find their way, that boats use it to locate themselves on the ocean. And I'm talking about 10-foot little boats, you know, with little outboard engine that are putting around. But it has not been made available to commercial air service. And that implementing that system, already in use by other modes of transportation, would produce estimated savings of approximately $5 billion per year for the airlines and for consumers. Ultimately, that system has the capability of providing zero-zero landing and taxiing and landing and taxiing and takeoff capability, which means when you can't see the runway, when you can't see overhead at all, you can still land and take off. You might not want to do that, but the capability could be there. And for that to work, it must be integrated with a completely modernized ATC system. And it was suggested by the Commission that this should involve a look at restructuring or reorganizing the FAA on behalf of the excellent people that work there so that in an unfettered, unconstrained way, they can accomplish the things that they need to do. The Commission suggested a federal public, not private, corporate entity within the Department of Transportation to manage and to fund the air traffic control system and related functions, with the source of funds being user fees. At that time, Senator Hollings had made it fairly clear that he was against any such proposal. Senator Ford appeared to be neutral. Chairman Mineta said that he thought it might be a good idea, but it would never pass the United States Congress. Chairman Oberstar was clearly opposed to it. And now it's clear that Chairman Ford opposes it as well, and Chairman Mineta is not very enthusiastic about the idea. And now that these positions have been taken, I think it's important that we consult and have a dialogue with the Congress and get the benefit of its expertise and its experience and its guidance as to how this should be accomplished, because the interesting thing about all this is that nobody gainsays that the end results are good. Nobody says action should not be taken. It's a question of how it should be taken and in what guise. And as someone once said, and I think it was me probably, or Bianca Jagger, I'm not sure which, or it could have been Calvin Coolidge, you know. He was a very valuable guy, very communicative, that there are 100 roads to Rome. And I think once a dialogue starts between the leaders of the Congress and the Vice President, if they're interested in achieving the same end results, which they are, I think that that will be able to be worked out politically, and I think it will be an excellent dialogue. And so we're looking forward to helping the FAA in that respect. With respect to regulatory burden, it's kind of interesting, and I made this point. I thought of it one night after a couple of pops. And that is that there is no regulatory budget for the federal government or any other government. In other words, you have this unseen tax person coming in, passing regulations and taking billions away from the American consumer with no identification as to what the costs are, and it might be well to quantify those costs so the government would have a better understanding of the costs it's imposing on the American consumer and the inefficiencies that it's creating with respect to our effective global competition with other countries around the world. Also, the suggestion was made, and I know that this is extremely radical, but nonetheless, we gathered our courage and made it, that the Congress and the Department of Transportation be informed of the cost of the legislation that they passed and the regulations that they adopted. And that in order to determine that cost, it might be well to have some objective and impartial mechanism to determine the cost versus benefit ratio of proposals that were made, because they are supposed to have some relationship to one another in other than political terms, in economic terms. Also, it was suggested that there be a regulatory review to eliminate or to amend existing regulations of the FAA and the DOT, since some of them have been in existence for about 50 or 60 years and really pertain to piston engine commercial aircraft, of which there are very few left in the United States. It was also suggested random drug testing rate be reduced from 50% random testing each year, since there is no incidents worth mentioning of drug use in the airline industry. And someone, whom I greatly enjoyed, said they also recommended that the pre-employment alcohol testing be done away with, saying that that was really an IQ test rather than the test of your use of alcohol, because if you showed up drunk for an interview, you shouldn't be hired, not because you were drinking, but because you were stupid. On this section of the Commission's report, the score is virtually 100%. The global positioning system is rapidly becoming a reality. The FAA is expediting its implementation every day and accelerating in that respect. It has abandoned the microwave landing system now, which was sort of an interim measure and not nearly as effective. The administration and the Congress have endorsed the concept that a change is needed with respect to the way the FAA is constrained and confined in light of the form of business it does, which is regulate and operate high-tech operating business day in and day out, that there should be reforms connected to its specific responsibility as a governmental agency. And I'm sure, as I said, that our political leaders in the Congress and in the administration will be able to work that one out among themselves. And we want the results. The form is subsidiary to that. And every recommendation that can be effectuated administratively without legislation has either been accomplished or is in the process of being accomplished as of the present time. The second thing the Commission pointed out, and you know, this was particularly insightful, I think, in an industry that lost $12 billion in the last 4 years, that since the time of the Wright brothers had a net deficit as a result of its operations. You know, somebody once said that if Wilbur and Orville were alive today, Wilbur would have to fire Orville in order to reduce their costs. That the industry needed financial strength in order to be able to respond rapidly to change. And the Commission said that the industry had partially been debilitated and weakened by some of its own decisions and some of its own actions during the 1980s. But it also pointed out that the industry is evolving in ways that are designed to rectify those problems. And by that I mean the elimination of unprofitable hubs. We were over-hubbed in the United States. Less emphasis on market share per se and more on profitability. The curtailment of capacity growth, bringing in new airplanes, productivity increases, and many such things. The key, however, I think, was the Commission's finding, which I think was amply supported by the financial community as well as the Department of Transportation and its studies, that a turnaround in the economy in and of itself would not cure the ills that beset the industry. That it would take until the end of this decade for the airline industry as a whole simply to repair the damage done to its balance sheets between 1990 and 1994. Because when you lose $12 billion, it takes some time to restore your balance sheet to its former condition. And against this, the industry, airline industry, really never achieves even the average profit margin for U.S. industry as a whole in the best of times, despite the fact that it's a very risky industry because it's fuel intensive, it's labor intensive, it's capital intensive, and it is intensely cyclical, ebbing and flowing, waning and waxing with the condition of the economy itself. So it should have a higher net profit margin if the old saw in America about the more risk, the more reward goes together. And that does not take into account the fact that because of the stage two noise rule, by the end of this decade, the industry is faced with replacing, re-engineering or hush-kitting 1,831 jets, and also renovating and improving all the major airports in the United States. That is a very heavy capital expenditure burden for an industry that has lost $12 billion in the last 4 years. Some of the recommendations that were made with respect to financial strength were that bankruptcy, which really repeals the law of supply and demand in America, Chapter 11, you know, the supply never disappears, it's just reconstituted after going through the washeteria and rematerializes as a lower cost operator, that there be a 1 year limit on the exclusive right to file a reorganization plan for airlines, and that the Secretary of the Department of Transportation be a party to airline bankruptcy proceedings so that matters of policy could be addressed in those proceedings. With respect to tax policy, it was recommended that the alternative minimum tax be reformed insofar as it pertains to capital-intensive businesses, not just airlines, since now capital-intensive businesses who are losing vast amounts economically are borrowing money to pay their taxes. That's hardly the way to refresh the investment base of America. That the increase in user fees and waybills that was put in December 1990 to offset the federal deficit. It could have been on podiatrists, grocery stores, or veterinarians. But airline passengers are easy to hit because they're transient, they're fugitives, and they usually don't vote where they're taxed. That was increased by 25%, of course, just as the war in the Middle East broke out, and was suggested that perhaps that ought to be rolled back to its original level of 8% and 5% instead of 10% and 6.25%. It was also recommended that airline fuel be exempted from the transportation fuel tax, which came up during that time and could impair the financial strength of an industry that uses about 22 billions of fuel, gallons of fuel a year, that there be a full deductibility for airline per diem payments, whatever they are, and that bar diversion of airport revenues from airports, which are totally self-sustaining, paid for by commercial air carriers, such as proposed in Los Angeles and some lesser items. The score was almost 100% on the first category of technological superiority and efficiency. On this one, I would have to say the score was probably about 20 to 25% at most. The alternative minimum tax has been changed slightly, but the problem remains. There will be some minor proposed changes to the bankruptcy laws, but no major ones. Insofar as user fees are concerned, budgetary problems are going to prevent anything being done about those. As far as the fuel exemption is concerned, it's for 2 years only. And as far as airport revenue diversion is concerned, DOT is formulating regulatory proposals right now, but legislation may be required. As far as the statute of repose is concerned, you may not realize that the United States was the general aviation leader of the world for many, many decades after the Second World War. Because of the fact that we allow lawsuits to be brought against general aviation manufacturers 35 years after they manufactured the airplane or the engine, and this is a tremendous tale of liability that accompanies that business now, we have lost that leadership and 100,000 jobs to other countries. It was suggested that maybe there ought to be a 15-year statute of repose so that after the product had been in the market for 15 years and airplanes are constantly being changed, refreshed, and so on, that there was no longer liability in an attempt to bring back 100,000 jobs in general aviation and our leadership in the United States. We used to produce 18,000 piston general aviation airplanes per year. I think now we produce something like 200 or 300. And that's because a company is being held liable for the performance of an engine that in one case it manufactured 32 years previously. And anybody who knows anything about airplane engines will understand that that had gone on, had undergone probably 15 overhauls during that time, that everything originally placed in the engine by the manufacturer had been replaced, and yet nonetheless held liable. There was a case where someone was trying to escape pursuers and jumped into a Piper Cub. And as they took off trying to escape their pursuers, they ran into a fuel truck that was in the runway. And the Piper Company was held liable for defective design with respect to this 1930 airplane because it was a tail dragger and you couldn't see over the top of the dashboard when you had the tail down. And so Piper received some liability for its defective design in that period. And the relief benefited an absconder who was being chased and didn't know how to operate the airplane. That's the kind of silly results that we're having in this area. And we think, we say we want jobs, but a lot of the things that we do really impede the creation of jobs. Access to global markets. Here, this is going to take a long time, but it's been suggested that the bilateral system, which Ed has organized a celebration of in Chicago in 1944, and which was an historic landmark, as a matter of fact, in the history of international aviation, that although that regime has been enormously productive, and that's what really built and made international aviation, that it's become a situation where, because of governmental bargaining, it's become sort of a zero-sum game where the market is the same, it's just a question of what piece of it you get, and that maybe we ought to go to multilateral agreements. And that's very difficult, that's very time-consuming, but I believe that the Department of State and the Department of Transportation are going to take that approach. And that's an approach that focuses on economic development and the economic development that air transportation brings, rather than the well-being of the individual airlines that may be the beneficiary of a particular a treaty. In the meantime, it was recommended that our current bilateral agreements, including denunciation of those, be enforced if necessary. And I'm very pleased and proud of the fact that our government is taking a very strong position. Secretary Pena is taking a very strong position with foreign governments, saying, hey, wait a second, you entered into this agreement, now observe it, or let's forget about it, which I think is fair. Ratification of the Montreal Protocols, number 3 and 4, with a supplemental compensation plan was also recommended. And I would say the score on this particular aspect is about 75% to 80%. The multinational policy is being adopted. We are more strictly enforcing the bilateral agreements. The ratification of the Montreal Protocols with some difficulty is proceeding in the Senate. But as a conclusion, and a lot of people said this after the Commission issued its report, they said, and they were appropriately skeptical, they said, you know, here's this commission that's worked for 69 days, and that's not enough time, and has come forth with these recommendations, and none of them are novelty. And, you know, American people love novelty. I went to listen to a Catholic priest one time giving a sermon, and he said, and I'm not Catholic, by the way, but he said, you know, instead of coming down each morning and saying hello to your mother, you could punch her in the nose. That's different. Is it good? Well, you know, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things that are good and have been recommended for a long time, but simply haven't been implemented and done. And as a totality, I believe that the Commission's efforts have been well received, that they were an excellent example of how citizen participation in government can be very serious in nature, can be constructive in outcome, and can be quickly productive in acceptance, and it's not necessary to have a 2.5-year commission to solve a fortnight's problem. An unexpected byproduct of the commission was that I now find that it's much easier for me to get reservations in Washington restaurants and decent tables when I say, this is Commissioner Kelleher calling, because nobody realizes that I was only a commissioner for 69 days. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Commissioner. lots of questions here. first question is, Do you foresee fewer or more airlines in the future? What would you consider the most important factors to an airline success?
I would think that there would be fewer airlines in the future because there are some airlines that are still in very bad financial condition, and they might not make it. So there may be some more consolidation in the industry. But as I mentioned earlier, this has nothing to do with the amount of competition there is in a given city pair market. And their disappearance will not have an adverse effect upon competition, as I think Southwest Airlines has recently demonstrated by going into BWI Airport in the fourth quarter of last year. As a result of our entry into the BWI Cleveland markets, the Cleveland market increased from 13,000 to 152,000 passengers in one quarter, and the Chicago market went from about 3,000 passengers to 64,000 in the first quarter of our entry. So there will be competition. The competition will be stimulative, and the number of airlines does not necessarily have any message to deliver about competition whatsoever.
This questioner would like to know, do you think the rules that allow some airlines to operate under Chapter 11 protection for years at a time are fair in a competitive market to airlines such as yours, which have not used that route? Specifically, would America West Airlines be out of business if not for Chapter 11?
Well, I think the English are smart enough to realize that Chapter 11 is a repeal of the laws of supply and demand, so they have refused to install it in their bankruptcy system. That at some point, if the fundamental economic doctrine that we're supposed to believe in exists, you have to allow excessive supply to disappear. There's no question that Chapter 11, not just in the airline business, but throughout American business as a whole, encourages people to take risks that they might not otherwise take because they have that safety net there. And they realize that the ones that are going to suffer are their employees and their creditors. The creditors aren't going to be paid, and the employees are going to have their wages and benefits cut substantially. And as far as the ongoing effect of it's concerned, it reminds me of that very old movie. And I may be the only one here that remembers that, Gil. Uh-huh. Gil said to me earlier, he said, I want you to sign this autograph book that goes back to the time of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I said, Gil, so do I. And but it was called LaRonde. And it was about passing syphilis around from one person to another. Well, I think Chapter 11 passes a very serious disease around from one company to another, because as soon as one eliminates its mistakes in the washateria of Chapter 11 and emerges as a low-cost competitor, it immediately impinges upon the wages, the benefits, and the economic stability of the ones who have not had that opportunity.
The country has seen other wonder airlines in the past, Braniff and Continental, to name a couple. Do you fear that you could follow their path by expanding too rapidly and then collapsing?
Well, first of all, I'd like to have your definition of the word wonder.
Ones that expand very rapidly.
And I think that Southwest Airlines track record of 21 consecutive years of profitability with never a furlough is an evidential refutation of any need for concern in that respect. And the fact that we have the only investment grade securities in the airline business, bar none, the rest are all rated junk, should again be an effective refutation of your need for concern about that.
This questioner would like to know, how did you develop your management style? It seems to be almost unique among CEOs.
Well, as Christy and I were talking earlier, before Mrs. Kennedy died, I used to say I doubt that Jackie Kennedy would regard it as a style, because she was very stylish and I am not. And I don't think that she would treat my sort of disorganized, even anarchic approach to life as a style. I think basically what it boils down to is that you recognize the great importance of people in the world and the great importance of people to any enterprise. And we have the philosophy at Southwest Airlines that our employees are the customers of our management, and that we are to serve them, and that we are sort of like the supply corps that makes sure that the trucks, the gasoline, and the cannons get to the troops on the front porch, on the front lines, I mean, and that's all we do. And that we want people who are individuals, We don't want people who are stamped out of molds. We don't want them to feel that they have to behave artificially when they're in a business environment. You know, Robert Frost said, isn't it a shame that everybody's mind works furiously until they get to work, and then they shut it off? And I haven't widely publicized this, but one of our ramp agents from Oklahoma City sent me a note in which he said, Herb, and I think you'll know why I haven't publicized this real quickly, and I know I'm not doing it now. Turn the cameras off, please. This is off the record. I have to burp, too. But he said, Herb, I know what you're doing. You're making work fun and home work. And really, if you have an environment where you're liberated, where you can be yourself, where you can be individualistic, where people are looking for results rather than form, where process is not important, but ends are, they find it a very stimulating environment. They are enormously creative, and they are tremendously productive. And it's because of their dedication to a cause. Most of our people don't think of Southwest Airlines as a corporation, which is just a little piece of paper in the Secretary of State's office, in our case, in Texas chain, and one of the last Texas corporations. Most of them are in Delaware, as far as their incorporation is concerned. And don't think of it as machines, don't think of it as seats, don't think of it as ticket counters, but think of it as people. The best slogan that we ever had was, in my opinion at least, we smile because we want to, not because we have to. And frankly, we would much rather have a company that was bound by love than one that was bound by fear and hierarchy and policing.
That sounds like heresy with a lot of companies. Do you see any other companies following this? Are they coming to study your management style, or what's going on here?
No, I meet with them in bars primarily, where I develop my management style. Yes, other companies do come to see us, and other companies do talk to us. And mainly it's because they're so pleased with what they see of the attitude of our people. And years ago, after deregulation, I took an enormous risk because we're sitting down with our advertising agency, which with our agency in and of itself is an enormous risk. It's GSD&M from Austin, which I've always said refers to greed, sex, drugs, and money. But they were talking about what kind of campaign we were going to have subsequent to deregulation, where everybody had airplanes, everybody had seats, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about our people because they're the most special people in the airline industry. And we went with the Southwest Airlines Spirit campaign. Now, if you think about it for just a second, and if you're in the marketing aspect of things at all, that is a horrendous risk, because on national television, radio, and in the newspapers, you're suddenly saying, our people are very special. Think of what happens if you're not right. I mean, that's a boomerang. That comes back and goes right between your eyeballs and will cause them to stick out in different directions, but which I think mine already do, except my ears obscure that fact. We never got any repercussions from that because our people really are special. They really are focused on the customer. Our checks that go to our people say from our customers, because we want to remind everybody that it's not some magician in the general office that produces that check. It's the customers of Southwest Airlines. And I think that's probably a key to it.
Okay. This questioner says, you mentioned that some airlines won't make it financially. Which ones do you think won't make it? Hey, I put you on the spot. And, and are employee-owned airlines better for an airline's long-term financial future?
We have now just gone into a deep backgrounder. Which airlines won't make it? It reminds me of when I was given it. You know, this is going to be a little indirection. You know what's coming. It's kind of like Abraham Lincoln was trying a case, representing a defendant in a criminal case, and he said, you know, the facts may be there. They may not be, you know, you can't controvert them at all. But he told the jury, he said, the conclusions are very important. And he said, it's like a little guy that lived on a farm in Illinois, and he came running in and he said, Daddy, I see Hiram the hired man out there with his pants down, and I see Sarah the housemaid there with her dress up, and I think they're getting ready to pee on the hay. So the facts are there, but you can get in trouble with the conclusions. And it reminds me when, how much time do we have? I was asked at a graduate school, they said, you know, how is Southwest Airlines made money when none of the other airlines had? And I said, well, you know, it's a very sensitive, competitive thing. It's very proprietary to Southwest. And I'm not going to tell you unless you all pledge me right here and now on your honor that you will never divulge this to anybody outside this room. So, you know, 450. And I said, okay, I'll tell you. And, you know, the clipboards came up, the recorders went on, the pads came out. And I said, here it is. It's better to be Irish than smart. Well, how much more time do we have? The answer is, it's very proprietary, and I ain't going to tell you. Now, I don't want to add to the woes of any other airline, and that does it, because passengers flee it as soon as they get the feeling that it may be a failing carrier, and frankly, airlines have enough problems without trying to use that against one another.
Anybody who can quote Lincoln to avoid answering the question has a spot for him in Washington.
Thinking of running for the Senate.
You got that here first. Here's something less proprietary. What markets does Southwest Airlines plan to enter in the near future?
And the profitable ones.
And are you planning to invade other nations?
No, I was very much in favor of NAFTA. And the reason I was in favor of NAFTA, quite frankly, is because Jane Hickey told me to be in favor of NAFTA. And all of us in Texas know that we should not cross her. But NAFTA really didn't do anything for commercial aviation. I mean, it's open skies for crop dusters and cloud seeders. And I told our pilots to stop those two activities about 5 years ago when we started making significant money in the passenger business and didn't need to do that anymore. But it's still a bilateral regime. There are still other government regulatory controls. And if you look at a carrier that never would have become an interstate carrier, we were intrastate to start out, if it hadn't been for deregulation, then at the same time you have to say consistently that that's a carrier that wouldn't want to get into a heavily regulated international regime where you're told where you can go, how many flights you can fly, and what the fares might be. On the other hand, we could change that because another principle at Southwest Airlines is that we never adhere too stringently to principles.
This questioner says, today's USA Today indicates that several Fortune 500 firms are seeking to get lower fares instead of frequent flyer mileage. What do you foresee as the future trade-offs between low fares and mileage credits?
I don't think that there's any real polarity to be addressed there. I don't think it's a question of, you know, do you or don't you, or black and white. I think that some corporations are going to be able to make arrangements with airlines whereby they get lower fees, lower fares, I mean, in return for not awarding frequent flyer miles. But that has a lot to do, really, with corporate backbone, because any company in America has the opportunity to tell its employees that your frequent flyer benefits will go to the company rather than to the employee. And I know some that have done that. And so I guess this is just sort of an indirect way of accomplishing the same thing and perhaps justifying it. But I would expect that to come on a company by airline and airline by company basis rather than as a policy across the airline industry.
This questioner contends that the traveling public seems quite satisfied, rightly or wrongly, with the safety record of FAA traffic controllers. Why should the public have greater confidence in a quasi-public FAA whose air traffic controllers might have different loyalties where the public interest is concerned?
The question is not really one of safety. There is no question that the safety record of the commercial airline industry in America is absolutely superb. And as a matter of fact, it's far better subsequent to deregulation, economic deregulation, than it was prior thereto. The question really is one of efficiency. The way that a lagging, technologically outmoded air traffic control system achieves safety is through delay. That means that your airplane sits on the ground instead of flying because the system cannot accommodate it. If you want an example of the way that that works, in 1981, as I remember, about 13,000 controllers walked off the job and were not replaced. Were there any accidents in air transportation? Does anybody remember any? No, there weren't any. And the reason for that was that you had a 75-mile separation between jets flying between San Antonio and Dallas, and the safety of the system was preserved in that way. Now you also had to wait for 2 or 3 hours in order to take off. So the question is one of efficiency, not one of safety. And insofar as having other operators of the air traffic control system, I'm not saying that's necessarily the way that it has to be accomplished. The FAA can be freed of its straitjacket in other ways, I'm sure. But if you look around the world, it's not as if this is something unprecedented. New Zealand has a privatized, not a public corporation, but a privatized air traffic control system, which is immensely successful and produces a profit each year, and so does Great Britain.
Ms. Wallace's question wants to know, what are your concerns, if any, relating to FAA Administrator Hinson's scale back of the advanced automation system?
I'll tell you, that is a very complicated, difficult undertaking that involves about 1,250,000 lines of software code. And frankly, I have to confess my inadequacies to you. I've only been through about half the code thus far. And I'm working on the remainder of it, but that is a very difficult project. I think it's time for its reassessment. I think it's gotten into a lot of difficulty for a congeries of reasons, and I think that the administrator is taking a very down-to-earth, very pragmatic, very business-like attitude towards it, because what he's saying is, let's evaluate what we have and see what's worthwhile and what's not. Let's see what we can put in that's off the shelf instead of being invented again for the sixth or seventh time. And let's freeze the requirements for the development of the system. You know, it's very hard to develop a complex system when the requirements are being changed on you every 2 weeks. And so I think he's taking a very logical and a very sound path. And I think what he's doing will actually expedite the implementation of the system. And my experience with systems, by the way, new ones, is that way. We had people working on the system for 2 years at Southwest Airlines. And it was the most complex flight-following real-time weather system of any airline in the United States. And we brought in a new systems fella, and he looked at it and he said, Herb, 80% of the benefits of this system have been here since the first 6 months. But they're trying to treat it as a perfect end game where everything has to be in place precisely. And I think the administrator is being very realistic and very pragmatic when he says, hey, there's a lot of value that's already been achieved here. Let's put that into effect. And then we'll smooth and we'll hone and refine and we'll add later. And we put our system in that system that I was talking about into effect, and it delivered 80% of the benefits. So we got 80% of the benefits while we're producing the 20% of the refinements. And I think essentially that's what he's talking about, if I understand his approach correctly.
Okay, this questioner says that the Wright Amendment, which limits flights from your home base of Love Field, is a perennial target of some congressmen, notably Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole. What do you think of this blatantly anti-competitive restriction on your business? Parentheses, speak freely, Jim Wright is no longer speaker.
Actually, we fought the imposition of the Wright Amendment on Love Field in Dallas. We went to court to stay at Love Field when the other carriers opened DFW Airport, which is the Fort Worth-Dallas Airport, combining both communities, whereas Love Field is really in downtown Dallas and much more convenient. And you know, if you'd like to spend less time getting to the airport than you are flying, you go to Love Field. But passing that, little marketing ploy. Jim felt, because of his constituency, that something should be done to limit the competition of Love Field with DFW Airport. We had a two-month battle up here, and our allies were Senator Long, who was then chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and went on every conference committee involving anything pertaining to aviation during that period, and Senator Packwood from Oregon. And ultimately, we worked out the compromise that Southwest could serve the four states contiguous to Texas, which doesn't make any sense, logically, but it is a political compromise, and that is an intensely inflammatory issue locally, because basically it's Fort Worth versus Dallas, and that's a feud that goes back for generations, and Fort Worth feels very strongly about keeping the Wright Amendment in place. To give you an example of what I'm talking about, when the Dallas City Council proposed to discuss the issue at a council meeting, Fort Worth got an injunction in a Fort Worth court prohibiting a public body from discussing a public issue. I myself thought, although I've not practiced law for many years, that there might be some slight constitutional infirmities in that injunction. But I offer that to you to show the heat that it generates locally. And as I was talking to a member of Congress about it one time, and he told me this story. He said that DFW had issued a report, which they had commissioned. And if you really read the report, which of course nobody ever does, they just characterize it the way they want to and say it supports their position. But if you really read the report, it said that DFW would continue to grow at a lesser rate, 9% instead of 12% a year if the Wright Amendment went away, which is not the equivalent of electrocution. Since most airports are growing at the rate of 1 or 2% a year anyhow. But in any event, he said he had a constituent call him, and he'd read the report. And he said, you know, that's just not the facts. And the guy said, Congressman, don't make any mistake. This issue ain't about facts. This is about emotions, and you got to get clued in. My point is that it is not about facts. It is about emotions. The emotions are very strong, and I doubt that anything will happen to the Wright Amendment within the near-term future, which at my age is what I gaze at persistently.
We are about out of time. We got the red blinking light here, don't go away yet. I've got, of course, gifts for appearing here. Certainly,
Gil, that's where I came. I had the feeling you were giving me something.
A very, very valuable National Press Club certificate of appreciation, suitable for framing.
Thank you.
And an exclusive National Press Club mug that you can put
Thank
there in
you,
your
sir.
Office.
I appreciate that. Can I put anything into it I want to?
Yes, it is suitable for coffee or bourbon, whichever you like best. I won't ask that question about who your successor is going to be, but
that was Howard Banks that asked that question.
Your roles as Elvis, Ethel Merman, and the Easter Bunny, do you have a favorite among those?
No, I prefer the role as charismatic and infallible leader. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNet Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.